trying to do here is for Missouri Baptists.
Yeah.
We're trying to think through some of these big issues that are going on just kind of in our modern context.
Yeah.
So based off of that, and did you have a chance to look over the questions?
I did. Let me look at them again,
sure,
but I did.
Absolutely.
I looked at them last night. They were online.
Yeah,
they were online.
I wanted to give you kind of just the brief nuts and bolts, as it were, but this is going to give it a little bit more context for each question.
Yeah, sure. Go ahead. Anything you, if you just want to ask.
Well, yeah. So I guess to get it started off, congratulations on your new book, by the way.
Thank you.
Martin Luther. I've enjoyed seeing and hearing him on YouTube, just the different things that people are saying about it.
It is. I mean, I've never written about as entertaining a figure in my life. I mean, he is an outsized, entertaining, you know, wild
Absolutely.
Man.
And I
have to say, it made it fun to write about him, and I hope it makes it fun to read about him. I just think it's a funny and entertaining, and hopefully inspiring story. But I was thrilled with the way it turned out. So thanks.
Well, absolutely. I look forward to reading it. It's very obvious to me. I mean, you've written a biography on Martin Luther, Dietrich Bonhoeffer. So obviously, the Christian heroes of the past are important to you, and understanding that's important.
Yeah,
to you.
Wilberforce was my entree into with the book Amazing Grace when the movie came out. That was my entree into the whole thing, and I never planned to write biographies. It's just one of those things. Sometimes God steers us.
Yeah, absolutely.
It just happened that I was on CNN, literally on CNN, talking about my apologetics book, Everything You Always Wanted to Know About God, and the woman who was the anchor asked me about Wilberforce, who I mentioned briefly. And that sets off a conversation. Next thing you know, I'm asked, would you like to write a biography on Wilberforce? Because there's a movie coming out, it's the bicentennial of the abolition of the slave trade. And I thought to myself, this is a crazy thing. Would I write a biography? So I wrote it, and of course it changed my life, because after I wrote the Wilberforce book, people said, who are you going to write about next? And for sure, I said, if there's any other biography, I'll write it be about Bonhoeffer. And then when the 500th anniversary came up, people were all over me thinking, you've got to do this. But I honestly never meant to write one, much less three.
So do you have an emphasis? I mean, I kind of answered it, but do you have an emphasis of the importance of Christians understanding these people of the past?
Oh, there's no question. I think that, and it's not just Christians, it's everybody. History is history. There's no such thing as Christian history any more than there's such thing as Christian math. And I think that sometimes we Christians participate in our own marginalization by acting as though we've got our own brand, or we have zero brand. Our brand is either truth, which is universal, or we have nothing. And if we believe something that's not universally true, we don't want to believe it, right?
Yeah.
So it's like when Paul says, if you know Jesus didn't rise bodily from the dead, we're to be pitied. And so I think that sometimes we approach other disciplines, once you get beyond theology, we kind of act like, well, here's our opinion, or here's what we're interested in. And you think, no, what Wilberforce did, what Bonhoeffer did, what Luther did, is at the very center of history. It has nothing to do with Christian history. It is history. Now, they were devout Christians, and everything they did was because of their devout Christian faith. So people who are interested in history need to deal with that, need to deal with the fact that you cannot escape the Christian influence on world history, mostly, dramatically, for good. And I think that because we do live in a secular culture where more secular academics who tend to be more secular, avoid these things or are uncomfortable with these stories, so then sometimes it falls to people like me maybe to say, hey, you've missed this, this is important. But Christians themselves need to stop acting like this is our history. We have no history. There's just history. And we should be proud and honored that those who've gone before us in the faith have contributed so centrally to all the good things that everyone, not just Christians, celebrate, that it's vital for a healthy conversation about everything to know this history. So that's part of what I want to do.
There shouldn't be a bifurcation of...
Well, of course not. Yeah. Any more than there should be a bifurcation of Christian music or Christian whatever. The point is, truth is truth, beauty is beauty, goodness is goodness. Those things are not Christian any more than an apple is Christian. Jesus created the universe, so every atom is stamped with him. He holds every atom together. So if you want to say the planet Saturn is a Christian planet, in some ways that's true, and in another way it misses the larger point. I mean, it was de Tocqueville, not de Tocqueville, I'm sorry, It was Abraham Kuyper who famously said that there's not a square inch of creation over which Jesus Christ, who is sovereign, does not say, mine. And we often participate in, as I said earlier, marginalizing ourselves and acting as we have this little religious sphere, we have this Christian sphere, we have this theological sphere. That's nonsense. If those things don't translate into every other sphere, including science, then what are we even talking about?
Yeah. Oh, that's really good. I appreciate that. And I know our readers are going to appreciate that too.
Great.
That's something that not a lot of people are saying. So you mentioned, you mentioned Kuyper, but speaking of Alexis de Tocqueville, the golden triangle of faith.
Yeah.
You know, the quote, liberty cannot be established without morality. Not without faith. So with that in mind and knowing how America has become more of a secular, moralistically secular, a nation, are we on the precipice of losing our liberty if we're starting to lose our faith?
There's zero question in my mind that we have been on that precipice for a few years now. Here's the fact. What Os Guinness famously calls the golden triangle of freedom, which I used in my book, If You Can Keep It, and which I'll talk about today, there is no other formula for self-government and true freedom. There is none. If you can find it, congratulations, I'm with you. But there is none other. We have this rare, really unique idea in what the founders pulled together that works, and it never worked at any time before in history, and nothing other than that has ever worked at any time since. There's a fundamental relationship between freedom and morality. I mean, self-government presupposes morality and virtue, which to a very large extent presuppose faith. But then faith itself cannot flourish without freedom. In countries where you don't have the freedom of religion, then freedom itself cannot flourish. Freedom of religion and faith go together. And so this is something that is so central that I think many of us have missed it because we've taken it for granted. We've just had it. It's been our legacy for 200 and something years, and we've hardly paid attention to it any more than we pay attention to the fact that we've got oxygen or sunlight. We kind of think, well, what else is there? We've always had this. But these things go away if you don't understand that they require keeping, which is why I titled my book, If You Can Keep It.
Yes.
They're utterly central. And so I was convinced in this last election, particularly the reason I advocated that people vote for Trump, was not because I approved of everything Trump has ever done or even approve of everything he does or says now, but because we had a choice between someone who might get this right and someone who surely had dedicated herself to not getting it right.
Absolutely.
And we were no longer in a position where we could afford 4 or 8 years of someone getting it wrong. We had had a history of decades now of people getting it just wrong enough that we were at a cliff's edge. And I did feel convinced that if you don't keep it, eventually you lose it forever. You don't lose it for 8 years. You lose it forever. You can't get it back, or you might not get it back for 100 years or ever. So it did strike me that this election was, unfortunately, that important.
Yeah, absolutely. Let me tie in a couple of questions just to be considerate of your time. A lot of people in Missouri, especially Christians in the pews, are worried about what they're seeing, you know, with the political landscape and the moral landscape of America. What would you say, and I'm going to tie two questions to this, what would you say would be a good place for a concerned Christian of, they're asking, what's the next thing for me to do? How do I help? How do I make a difference? What would you say would be the best way to do that? And tied into that, Socrates in the City. I appreciate all that you guys do. I follow that on YouTube. Tying that into self-examination in the community, how did those tie together, making a difference, and then the community helping with the self-examination?
Well, I think, first of all, what Tocqueville saw and what Os Guinness makes really clear, and I, of course, try to make it all the clearer in my own book, is that unless you have a population of faith, a citizenry of faith and virtue, the things that almost every American values will eventually go away. Mm-hmm. We have had that citizenry for about 200 years, but in the last 40 or so years, we have done something we've never done before, and we've slid in a kind of secular direction where we have forgotten the link between faith and freedom. If Christians, first of all, do not understand this and understand that their role as citizens in being full-throated Christians who understand and live out their faith, if that is not taken extremely seriously and lived out seriously, we lose everything. In other words, it now falls to the church in America who understand these things to understand that it is up to them to live this out. But we haven't had to do that before. We had a country where most people kind of got this. But now we're at a point, I think, where only people who are thinking about this, who are understanding it, who are conscious of it, and who understand it explicitly, it's no longer implicit, need to understand that, okay, it is now up to us, first of all, to tell everyone else about this idea. It's why I go around talking about my book, If You Can Keep It, in the Golden Triangle of Freedom, because I say if we don't teach these things to a couple of generations that have forgotten them, it's game over. So the first thing we need to do is understand these things ourselves, understand how vital our faith is in this, and then teach these principles to our kids, to our peers, to our neighbors. Make them understand there is no other way. All of these things that value can work. As I said before, if you can find it, congratulations. Yeah. But in 240 years, this is the only way true self-government and true liberty can work. So our first responsibility is to teach it, to talk about it. And that's, you know, a big part of what I do. And it's why I wrote the book, because I think that this is, we are at the end of the 11th hour. Now is our time to understand that this is crucial. We no longer have any grace time. This is it. Yeah. I would say, you know, maybe this administration, maybe even these next few months until the 2018 election, it's all we have. So if we're not all in immediately, we could lose it. So it's that urgent.
So at the sake of oversimplification, maybe you would say intentionality, like that, just to
oversimplify. That's a word that I would use. Yeah, okay. We have to understand that these are things that we can't take for granted, and we can't assume that they're happening, principally because they're not happening. We need to do it. Christians need to be active politically. Christians need to be active in their communities. Christians need to be active in all aspects of their communities, because Tocqueville and the founders understood that without that, the whole thing goes away.
Absolutely. Let me ask just one final question, and I'll, again, kind of put two sides to
it. Sure, whatever you like.
You've been very adamant about abortion and pro-life, which absolutely, we're in absolute agreement with this. What would you say, well, I mean, this is the obvious question, is life worth fighting for in the womb? And secondly, what measures would you say to Christians that we should take to help prevent abortion? And then past that, what do you think is the next great trial that's going to be on the church going forward in America?
I think that, you know, abortion gets to all the issues I was just talking about. Once you have a citizenry that fails to govern itself in a robust way, what happens inevitably is the government, which is to say them versus us, grows. And so we become divorced from the government and the political process, and we allow ourselves to be governed from without rather than governing ourselves from within. So what happens immediately is you get a federal government that grows and grows, and that begins to dictate to states and to communities standards that those communities don't share. That's the beginning of the end of self-government. Once the federal government grows that big, you have a kind of tyranny, and maybe it's not tyranny, but it's a pre-tyranny, and you're on the road to tyranny, because you no longer have people in states saying, we believe this about abortion, we believe this about marriage. Once that happens, it's kind of like a snowball effect where people sort of assume that's the way it is. The government has the right to tell us these things. If we don't understand that the government, in fact, does not have the right, that the people have the right to dictate to the government what they believe and how they want to behave, if you begin to lose touch with those basic civics lessons, then it sort of snowballs. And so the first thing you have to do is, you know, to use the term, drain the swamp. The government needs to become smaller, and the government needs to become increasingly local. The more local the government is, the more you have true self-government. Mm-hmm. And so the first thing, you know, people talk about rolling back Roe v. Wade. Well, all Roe v. Wade did is allow the states to determine how they believed on this. So New York and California will probably still have very liberal abortion laws. But the point is, you cannot and ought not be able to force everyone in America to abide by those kinds of laws. And I really think that that's the first step in self-government, is saying that we need to reduce the scope of the federal government and help people to understand that they've got to govern themselves on the local level and the state level. They've got to be involved. The price you have to pay for self-government is that you have to do something that you wouldn't have to do if you're governed from without. If you have a king or a tyrant, you don't have to do anything. You just sit there and obey. Yeah. But if you want freedom and self-government, you have to pick up that slack and do it. And I really think that we've gotten used to other people doing things for us. Even the way the Iraq war was fought. It was kind of like, we've got a professional fighting class, just go and shop and keep the economy robust. That we began to farm out what ought to be the responsibility of every single citizen to a kind of a professional class, as a professional ruling class, as a professional military class. That's against everything the founders stood for. And so I think that these are the kinds of fundamental things that if we don't understand them and if we don't teach them, we will inevitably lose the greatest freedoms that any nation has ever had. And then we lose the ability to share those freedoms with the rest of the world, which is exactly God's point in allowing us to have those freedoms.
Do you think that the church can thrive or flourish or even maintain existence in a increasingly tyrannical society?
There's no question that this cuts both ways, in the sense that the federal government and governmental power, by definition, begins trying to aggregate more power, which is to say, yeah, silencing the voices of people who have different ideas. So everybody in America has to understand that we've got to fight for these things, not because we want to preserve our own rights, but because if we want to have the right to serve others, if I want to have the right to help others in my community and to be the church, to be salt and light, I have to be able to exist. I have to be able to have the right to do those things. So a large federal government militates against that, and we need to understand those things. We're at a unique moment where, let me put it this way, my Bonhoeffer book is like the textbook in how not to do this.
Yeah.
The Germans waited just too long until the window of opportunity closed, and once the window closed, it was game over. The German church was dead, defanged. They had no power, and Hitler was able to take over and take the country off the cliff for 80 years. They've never recovered. We have a moment, thanks to this last election, where the church can still do some of the things that it needs to do. If we don't do those things now, then it's on us. But we have a window of opportunity. It's a small window. But if we don't take it very seriously, and if we don't take this next election, for example, very seriously, we are fools. It will be on us. We had an opportunity. Unfortunately, this is a very important election. Yeah. Unfortunately, we have no choice but to step up. And if we don't step up, we'll have no one to blame but ourselves.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Metaxas. Could I ask two favors of you before you go sign the book?
Yeah.
Could you start out with one of mine? My dad gave this to me in 2011 when I was still in college.
Oh, my gosh.
And it has just been incredible for me. So I very much appreciate your book. That was one of the first ones that I read that I didn't have to read. And I very much appreciated it.